I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back to the Annapolis Summit here at the historic Inns of Annapolis, the Calvert House, right across from the state capitol. I want to remind you all that this is our partners in this, have always been, remain in the last 8 years, the Baltimore Business Journal. We couldn't do this without them, getting the guests here and everything else with our print partners. WEA Radio, of course, Delmarva Public Radio, we'll be broadcasting on. We want to thank the Baltimore City Office of Cable and Communications, Channel 25, for taping and showing this on their channel and around the state of Maryland, national TV, and for on the internet, and of course our sponsors, Stevenson University, the Maryland State Education Association, and the Greater Baltimore Committee, for making all this possible today. And now we're about to start our conversation with Governor Martin O'Malley. And Governor O'Malley, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Good to be with you, Mark. This must be the beginning of the session because I'm here with you.
That's the way we start every year, isn't it?
That's right.
So here we are, start of the session, and one thing I have to ask you, given everything that's happened in the last 2 weeks between the letter explosions that happened, bombs, not really bombs, but the things that were sent to the state and what the tragedy just happened in Arizona, where a federal judge, a little girl, other citizens, congresswoman shot, people murdered. What that says to you about where we are, I mean, curious where we are as a state and country. Let me just leave it there before I ask anything about security issues. But, I mean, what does it say to you about what we're facing in America when we're at a point where we're seeing this kind of violence take place? You know, we are probably the most violent country of all the liberal democracies in the world. Something's amiss.
Right.
And even our state, you're seeing murders, Prince George's County, Baltimore City, Baltimore County, all across the state of Maryland on the rise.
Right. Boy, where to begin with all of that? I think the most fundamental obligation that any of us in public service have, and probably the most fundamental obligation that any of us who bear that title of citizen have, is to watch out for the safety of one another and to protect and defend life in our neighborhoods, on our streets, in our communities, and throughout our country. There is right now, I think, across our entire country, a debilitating fear that is felt in every quarter, that somehow these challenges that we face might be beyond our ability to address, and that perhaps we might be the last generation of Americans that's able to pass a better way of life on to our children. In that mix of fear and frustration about the future is cast this long shadow of violence. Every few weeks, another young Marylander and young American coming back as having given their life in Iraq or Afghanistan. The sort of rhetoric on the air and the violence that we just saw in Arizona, the violence that has started off this new year that you mentioned, there is a long shadow of violence cast over our country at a time when we're all very, very confused. And what we need to figure out how to do as a people is to turn to each other, realizing that the answers to these big challenges aren't things that any one of us has individually, but they are things that we have the freedom to find together. If we look at our neighbors, including and perhaps even especially those who disagree with us, as a source rather than someone that we need to fight with or disagree with. And that's really our challenge in a smaller setting in our state. And that's what this General Assembly, I think, is going to be about, turning to each other, even in our disagreements, to find a way forward and to rekindle that notion that, in fact, with hard work, with sacrifice, and with some brain power and cooperation and collaboration, we actually can make this world a better place for our kids.
So can you give us a sense of where we're going to go in the state of Maryland? I know you're going to give your state to state. You won't do it now. Unless you'd like to. Would you like to give the state to state now?
Well, I thought that last bit was pretty good. Sure. Let me. We're coming off of four very, very difficult years in this last session.
Yep.
In many ways, I mean, the mood of the country right now, our view of ourselves is so very different than it was 4 years ago, and it's very different than even it was 2 years ago when President Obama was sworn in. But the mission, I think, remains the same. There is a tremendous change going on in our economy, And the states that are, there are going to be states that aren't able to make this change in a successful way. There are going to be states that, instead of leading other states as we are out of this recession, there'll be states that stay in recession and slip back. What determines whether a state moves forward or whether it slips back is the will that we have to protect important priorities that allow us to make this turn into the new economy. The education of our children. Third year in a row, best public schools. We have a lot of room for improvement. Still a lot of schools where we still have a lot of work to do, but compared to the other 50 states, number one public schools in America 3 years in a row. The strides we've made over the last 4 years in making college more affordable, strides that we need to continue to make. The investments that we make to spur innovation, the life science, the biotechs, all those innovation assets that we are almost, you know, so commonplace in our state. Mm-hmm. We look at them more as sources of traffic than we look at them as sources of innovation and creation. But these are the assets we need to harness. We need to spur with things like the R&D tax credit, the biotech tax credit, the Invest Maryland proposal that we're putting in to channel $100 million into the Maryland Venture Fund. These are all of the things along with pushing the envelope on cleaner, greener, smarter future in terms of the natural resources, the beauty of this place and renewable energy and that allows us to live in a better balance. These are all the things that you have to do all at the same time. I wish it were so easy that you could say, you know what, this one's our priority. Everything else in the budget needs to be cut and we must only do this. But we have to figure out a way with a $1.3 billion gap, disconnection, if you will, between our revenues and between our projected expenditures, how to do all of those things still and do them simultaneously. Because in order to make progress on one, you have to do all of them at the same time. And that's what this next session is going to be about. And because, and people will soon realize just how very essential President Obama's leadership and help was with the Recovery and Reinvestment Act, but because that's about $750, $800 million that we do not have in the budget this year that we had last year.
So what do you do? Raise taxes? Where are you going to cut? I mean, what can you give us a sense of where, what we're going to lose and what we're going to have to pay for and how we're going to do it? Are you going to propose that we raise gasoline taxes, income taxes?
I'm submitting a budget, as I've said several times, that will be balanced entirely by cuts. Over the last 4 years, we've made about $5.6 billion in cuts. 3 years ago, we raised by one penny what was the nation's 42nd lowest sales tax. We did that before the recession hit, and in hindsight, I think all would agree that regardless of the policy, mathematically, that has certainly allowed us to fare much better than other states that weren't able to forge that precious consensus before this wave of recession hit. We did a couple of other things in that session as well, the tobacco tax and those things 3 years ago. Ever since then, Mark, we've been going back to the Board of Public Works very quickly and finding the consensus to continue to cut and to cut and to cut. This next budget will be submitted and balanced entirely with cuts and transfers and all of the similar sort of things that you've seen us do for the last 3 years. Now, I don't for a second expect that that will be the last word on this budget. That, far from it, will be the first word. That's my constitutional duty, is to submit a budget. And I will submit that budget, as I promised, that will be balanced entirely with cuts. And then we're going to have a conversation, like the conversation you just had with the Speaker and the President.
So where will the cuts come from?
All over the place. I mean, think about this. 83% of your state tax dollar goes to public education, public health, and public safety.
Right.
Everything else is in that other 17%. So we have advocates here for the arts. We have some people here who are lawyers, and you know, the courts are part of that other 17%. Department of Natural Resources, Department of Environment, Department of Agriculture are all in that other 17%. So when people say, look, cut everything you need to in government. Government's too bloated. Government's too big. Just don't cut it out of the priorities of public health, public safety, or public education. Well, that's 83% of the budget. We have been able, over the last 4 years, in part because of the tough choices we made earlier, and also for the last 2 years because of President Obama's courageous leadership and the Democratic Congress, we have been able, in some instances, to to maintain virtually level funding. In most all others, we've cut. And in the one exception to all of this, we have increased by about $1 billion the investment that we've made in public education over these last 4 years. So the cuts will come from all of those things. And this is not the day that I submit the budget, but the sort of increases that we've made to education in the past, the notion that somehow we can just go back and find another $150 million in the drawer, does not square with reality. And so we're going to protect our priorities like public education, affordable college, the others I mentioned, but it's going to be painful. And like I say, that'll be the opening of this conversation. And there's a lot of new members. There's a lot of senators and delegates, all of them independently elected, and I'm sure they'll all have ideas for how we can go about this in a better way for the greater good.
Now, folks, I know there's a microphone here. I want to get you up early to begin your questions. We start with public radio. Don Marvin, in just a few minutes, who asks the first question always. Here with WEA Public Radio, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and also being heard with our partners at Eastern Shore, Don Marvin Public Radio. And we'll come right to questions, so start lining up so you can get in there.
I was on the Eastern Shore. I was talking about you the other day. I was over there with Tom Horton.
He's working with us on our On
yes,
the Marvin series.
And I was at his side as he recorded the Tundra Swans flying
you were with him when
the
he did
Marshy
that piece?
Hope. Yes. He didn't give me credit on that?
He did not. Did the governor get credit for that? He didn't, huh?
Whistling Swans.
My producers say he didn't get credit. Sorry. But we talk about places to cut and reform government. And it's been one of the things I've talked about for the last 18 years, so I'll do it a little bit more here again. It's in the criminal justice system. African-Americans make up 0.6% of the world's population. African-American men make up 8% of the world's prison population. 8%. Something's amiss. Why is it so difficult to put our hands around this? Why is it so difficult for us to really, even though you've made efforts and tried to hire people to do it, to reform our criminal justice system, reform our penal system, to reform our juvenile justice system, to reform our court system so that we incarcerate less while keeping the streets and people safe, but we incarcerate less and do more in the community? Something's amiss when that many people of color in our country and state are filling up our prisons. It's insane. There must be a way out of this and a way to reform the system that can also save perhaps tens and hundreds of millions of dollars in our state budget if it was done more through community corrections and less through incarceration.
There are always improvements that we can make to our system. If I ever had two nickels to rub together and ever saw something, that elusive bird known as the supplemental budget that governors past have had, I would love to invest more in reentry services. Haven't been able to do that these last 4 years. We have, though, been able to do a lot more on the other. I mean, we have been able to protect the things that we do within our prisons in terms of the training and in terms of the drug treatment programs. Believe it or not, even though we were paying for drug treatment programs in the prison, about 30% of them were slots that never bothered to be filled, just because of poor operations. So there's always things we can do to reform and change the system. If you look at the percentage of people who die violent deaths in our state, Mark, I would dare say an overwhelmingly large percentage of those persons are young and black and poor men.
Yep.
The reform that's required, that's much bigger and much deeper than a reform of the system, is a reform of our society. And there are many fronts to that. Education, creating opportunities and jobs, so there's some hope out there that when you play by the rules and work hard, you can make it in this country and create a better life for your kids. But it's a problem that did not begin in our generation, but we all have to take responsibility for improving it in the short time we have here. And I'm very proud of what the neighbors of the city of Baltimore have done over the last 11 years. The third largest reduction in violent crime of any major city, over 500,000 in America. over the last 10 years. Last year, notwithstanding that every loss of life is an unfathomable tragedy, last year was the lowest number of homicides that we've ever had in the city of Baltimore. So there's a lot to this.
There's a lot to this, and I think the strides we've made are incredible.
And the drug treatment as well.
And I'd be the first to say that. But is it time for us to have, and I hate commissions because the reports always end up just going on the wall, collecting dust over the years, as we've seen over and over again ad nauseum in both of our careers. But is it time to pull together the chief judge, the judges of our criminal justice system, state's attorneys, police commissioners, human service workers, to come up with policy changes that actually incarcerate less Marylanders, save us money, and keep our streets safe? I mean, that to me is what we're not doing, it seems. That we're not really, you know, sometimes the, whether it's the correctional officers unions, not to dump on them alone, or in other places are very, and the people who make lots of money off our prison system want to keep building these prisons, building out more prisons, building a new juvenile prison, build a new women's prison in Baltimore City. But maybe what we need to do is incarcerate less and figure out how to do that and create policy changes in the next 4 or 5 years that can accomplish that.
There are in fact many things that we have been doing and are doing. I'm not as much of a fan of commissions as I am of graphs that show us whether we're moving in the right direction or the wrong direction. Nothing's more satisfying than a graph that's moving in the right direction. But nothing's more useful than a graph that's flatlined or moving in the wrong direction and that's open and visible and easy for everyone, for every stakeholder in our state to see. Many of the things that have happened in this whole continuum, I mean, it's not simply a matter of sending an order to the police, make sure you arrest three less people every night for the next month. That's not how, of course,
right.
This works.
Right.
The way it does work, though, is to understand that there is a continuum, a pool of ever-increasing depth, if you will, that begins when children are very young and come into households that are very vulnerable, very fragile, very troubled, and that child, you need to have interventions every step of the way. You cannot reform your prison system unless you're also reforming your juvenile justice system and you're also reforming your child welfare system and you're also reforming how we serve the needs, prevent harm to the most vulnerable families in our society. And those are the things we've been doing in DHR and in the Department of Human Resources and Social Services. Those were the things that Brenda Donald had been doing in conjunction with the Casey Foundation and a lot of good people who are bringing best practices and the things that work. Those are the things we're doing in juvenile justice, probably one of the most underfunded and troubled agencies that the O'Malley Brown administration took charge of. I wish we could get it done sooner, but we are moving in the right direction.
And looking for a new secretary.
We are looking for a new secretary.
So one of the questions...
We're looking for several new secretaries, as a matter of fact. Turn resumes into Mr. Sean Adamack over there.
please. Just after we finish. Don't walk around the camera. One more question here, but I'm going to come back to the audience. This would be a year when gay marriage comes to the floor in the House and the Senate. And we're talking about a gay marriage bill that is also a Freedom Act for religions, that nobody has to marry anybody in their churches, synagogues, mosques, temples that doesn't fit into their religious belief system, but allows gay and lesbian men and women to have full rates of marriage in the state of Maryland. Do you support that? Will it pass? Are you going to be an advocate for it or something else?
I believe that we need to find ways that we can protect freedom of religion and that we can also protect rights equally. And I think the best way to come together around this is to try to move beyond the labels and the titles and look at how this impacts a child of a same-sex gay couple as that child grows into adulthood and has a right to expect certain protections of law and certain that every other child of of straight couples has protected. And I think if we look at it through that lens, maybe we can get beyond these titles that rightly drive people into opposite sides of the room, whether it's civil unions or marriage or civil marriage or any other the labels attached to it. I will sign a bill that comes to me from the General Assembly and that protects rights equally and that also protects religious freedom. And the title on that bill is of less concern to me than the rights of children and families that are affected by the dignity and equality with which we accord marital and lifelong commitments.
Let's go to the audience. I can follow up, but to be fair, we'll go to the audience. And first, from Public Radio DelMarva.
Yeah, John Rush from Public Radio DelMarva. I know you don't want to talk about raising taxes, and you've said that you don't want any taxes in your tax increases in your budget. What about the shifting of some of the teachers' retirement benefits to the counties? Is that in the works? I know you're not particularly a fan of that. Are you open to it? And we heard a suggestion actually earlier this morning that perhaps local governments were relying too much on property taxes, not taking advantage of the opportunity to tax other things in order to shore up their budget. What about that? Are you inclined towards shifting that burden to the county? Are you open to it? What's your sense about that?
Yeah, there's a couple things in your question. The I never took the what I believe to, and honest people can disagree, but I never took what I thought to be an irresponsible pledge that I will never ever raise any taxes ever in this second term. There's a lot of people, particularly those serving in our military, who are giving up a lot more than a penny on this or a penny on that. But I also did say and continue to and will fulfill the commitment I made to submit this year's budget balanced entirely with cuts. As far as shifting state obligations to the counties, they're in no better position to pick this up than we are. In fact, some of our jurisdictions are in a far worse position to pick this up. We would all be best served, I think, if the state fixes whatever's wrong with the trajectory of our increases, with our commitments and our gaps and our shortfalls before we have the conversation about whether we shift this or whether we shift that or whether we share some other piece. The context in which this usually comes up is the teacher pensions. We are one of the few states that entirely covers our teachers' pensions. And there are many who believe, as I do, that that has been overall a very positive step. You know, number one schools 3 years in a row, we've been able to retain quality teachers in our state, and we do so better than most. President Miller, you heard him argue that there's no, in the law, what they call privity of contract, that the people agreeing to raises for this particular group of employees, namely our teachers, our nation builders, are not the people that have to go balance the math in terms of cuts and revenues, and that there needs to be a more a closer relationship connection there. So that's a conversation we've had every year for the last 4 years. I'm going to focus on shifting our pension, fixing our pension commitments, not on shifting our pension commitments.
Would that include, for instance, hiking, for instance, the contribution that people put in, the teachers put in?
Oh.
Because I understand that there's some strong labor opposition to that.
Oh, I'm sure there will be. this is not a, I wish it were possible to eat cake and lose weight, but the world does not work like that. So we're going to have to do more as an employer. Our employees, not just teachers, but all our employees who have been paying into the fixed definable benefit for years are going to have to pay a little more. But I think one area where I think all of us can agree, even if we have different perspectives on how to go about bringing these lines into balance, is that we should defend, we should save, we should find a sustainable way to keep the defined benefit pension and not privatize this into 401ks or condemn it to some sort of long-term, you know, death by a thousand cuts by having all the new people on 401ks and watch the whole thing crumble on somebody else's watch 15 years from now. We got to come together. We got to make the tough decisions to save these pension systems.
Okay, I just want to follow up just finally with something with Mark. It's been pressing you about. You said that you're going to submit a budget that's balanced with cuts, but obviously it goes to state legislature. if you're faced with proposals for tax increases that come from the state legislature, what kinds of tax increases are you open to?
Well, we could play this hypothetical all day, couldn't we?
When
we looked at these things in the past, what you always have to keep in mind is the context within which we compete for economically in our throughout our whole region, throughout our country, increasingly now throughout the world. So one of the reasons, I'll just tell you in retrospect to just share some of our reasoning, one of the reasons we looked at that sales tax in the special session 3 years ago was because it was the 42nd lowest in the country. Having raised it by one penny, we're now the 32nd lowest in the country. The reason for that being that unlike other states, we don't allow all of the counties to tack on their own portion, with the exception of the hotel tax. But by and large, we don't have a local sales tax. So that was our thinking behind that, was that that penny, if it allowed us to improve public safety, improve public education, improve our quality of life, safeguard the things that make Maryland, Maryland, we figured that most people would agree that on balance, we could give up being 42nd lowest sales tax in order to make those other things happen. So I think whenever you look at these things, you have to look at our competitive position. I'm sure that, and I hope that's what the legislature is doing. I know that there are many people advocating an increase in the alcohol tax or the drink tax and those things. And no doubt in the course of those conversations, I hope that we all look at the context within which those choices are made, namely, what is it in Virginia, what is it in the district, what is it in Pennsylvania, which is not to say that we should always rush to be in the middle of the pack, but it is to say we have to be cognizant of the balance that we maintain here.
Thank you. We have about 2 minutes to break, so this is what I think we'll do. I think we'll go to break a tad early, so we don't interrupt the question and an answer, and we'll come right back in just a minute. We're here at the Historic Inns of Annapolis, our 8th annual Annapolis Summit with Governor Martin O'Malley, of course, being broadcast as it has been on WEAA 80.9 FM, the voice of the community, our sister stations, Delmarva Public Radio, Mayor's Cable Station. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner here at the Historic Inns of Annapolis, our 8th annual Annapolis Summit. On WEAA.FM in Baltimore and Delmarva Public Radio broadcasting this, along with the Baltimore City Office of Cable Communications, TV25, and our partners, the Baltimore Business Journal, that we partner with on this every year here in Annapolis, and couldn't do it without them. Center for Emerging Media that produces the Mark Steiner Show, Stevens University, Maryland State Education Association, the Greater Baltimore Committee, all of whom are sponsors of today's event. And we are now here with Governor Martin O'Malley and going to the audience. But there's one burning question before we're allowed to go to the audience.
We will defeat Pittsburgh this weekend.
We better, yes. You have to. You see what color I have on, don't
it's
you?
It's good. Very good.
All right. Yes, it has to happen. Will you, in the second term, rejoin O'Malley's march?
We actually played right before Christmas, and I was going to tell you in the break. We did. I went back over 6 years and pulled all of our original stuff, put it on one CD, and remastered some of the older things through the modern technologies of that beautiful thing called pitch correction. And I dare say we never sounded better. You have to have music. Music's all that keeps us here. It's the great Paul Levinson.
Paul Levinson. Paul Levinson is a. Just to let you all know who that is, was the piper in the band, and he passed away from brain cancer, and he was actually, oddly, as it may seem to you, he was close friends, one of my closest friends in life, and one of Martin O'Malley's closest friends in life, and we were with him at the end of his life a lot in his parents' apartment, so that's who Paul Levin is, a great human being.
The Piper of Pikesville.
The Piper of Pikesville, he certainly is. So I'm sorry, remember Paul. Sir, go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Bill Fisher. I'm a 37-year veteran teacher from Charles County, Maryland. And I'd like to say that thanks to the historic funding that you and the Maryland General Assembly have received for our schools, and thanks to our great educators and our students, Maryland schools were ranked, as you just said, 3 times, number 1 in the country. I know we have a difficult budget year ahead of us. You've been saying that. We've been reading in the paper. But, you know, I've been hearing that for about 37 years. It's always a difficult budget. So my question is, what will it take for us to navigate the path ahead and be able to celebrate a 4th number one ranking next year?
We've got to continue to work hard. We have to continue to have high standards. We have to have high expectations of our students, and we have to listen to and support our nation builders, our teachers. And as we do that, administrators are going to be very, very challenged because the sort of huge ramp up, approximately $1 billion, that has been coming to our public schools, even through these difficult times, is not going to continue to ramp up. We need to protect that investment, but the administrators all need to look at their own administration and figure out how they can squeeze dollars out of administration in order to support and defend that essential teaching mission as we move forward to better days, work our way forward to better days. When the economies rebound, we'll make our revenues rebound, and we can get to a more sustainable and predictable path of growth. Thank you.
Next question.
And thank you for teaching.
Good morning, Governor O'Malley. My name's Steve Braco. I'm a maintenance worker from Frederick County Public Schools. We're all making sacrifices all across the board, and we've made some small ones, and I suppose we're going to be asked to make more. And, you know, I guess that's the way things are. But and even the Chesapeake Bay is going to make a sacrifice with the way things are. What are the wealthy of the state? What sacrifices are they making? And if we're not thinking about raising any taxes on them or anything like that, is there some other way to get them to contribute more to the prosperity of the state?
Wow. For the first time ever, we put into place in that special session 3 years ago a progressive income tax. So we, in order to offset the sort of regressive nature of additional penny on the sales tax, we actually increased, not that anyone remembers, increased the personal exemptions and exemptions for dependents, and we lowered the income tax for I think roughly 90%, 88% of Maryland families. We raised it on the highest percent of Marylanders, and ever since that time, wealthier Marylanders have been paying a slightly higher personal income tax. For a time, those that make over $1 million were paying a higher rate even on top of that highest. That has since sunset. But to this day, I mean, we do have a progressive income tax. One of the big challenges in this world of where people are pulled apart and there's disconnections and gaps, one of the biggest disconnections and gaps we have right now is in our perception of and the reality of what it takes to support the things that we want and that we believe are our priorities. In other words, I think the percentage that's paid in taxes by average Americans, it's actually lower now than it's been at any time, I think, since the 1950s. Possibly its lowest was in 2009, 2008, because of things in the Recovery and Reinvestment Act. But wages, for the first time since the Second World War, have been going down for 10 years. So there's things that you cannot control, and things that people are angry about because they've been spinning out of control. The annual 15%, 17%, 20% increases in health care that we've experienced, and that's against the backdrop of wages that have gone stagnant or have actually started to dip in our country. That's the first time that's happened. So not an easy time to have this conversation, but there is a big gap in our country between what we expect and what we're willing to pay for it. I wish I knew the answer to your question.
Just to follow up on his question, and the next question coming up to the mic. There is a huge gap in wealth in America and in our state of Maryland, everywhere else you look. So the question is, to follow up what our guest, customers is asking, does wealth pay enough? We tax income, we don't tax wealth. In America. We don't tax the hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars in dividends people make on there, and we don't tax that at all. Should we be? Do you think the wealthy in America, do you think corporations in America are paying their fair share, given that wages have gone down, they're stagnant, people are losing their homes, homes are underwater? I mean, when you get back out there in 4 years and leave the governor's mansion and have to go buy a house, you know, that those of us who bought houses in the last 3 or 4 years, we've seen our values just plummet. They weren't really to begin with, but they plummeted. Many of us are underwater. I'm one of those folks whose home is not worth what it was when I bought my house. So the question is everyone paying their fair share to support the America that we want?
That's not just a dollars and cents question. Where to begin with that? Is everyone paying their fair share? Over the last 40, 50 years, what you've seen happening at the federal level anyway. And by the way, to the gentleman that asked a question about corporations also were asked to pay more, and we split that 1% increase between higher education, the first trust fund for higher education in Maryland, also transportation trust fund. And so corporations also were asked to pay more, and they have, although it's a lower corporate income tax rate than Delaware, Pennsylvania, D.C., not lower than Virginia. But over the last 40, 50 years, there's been a shift away from corporate income tax and a shift towards payroll taxes. And at the same time, right, we've seen this wage stagnation, we've seen this healthcare hyperinflation, and so that's been the reality of these last 40, 50 years. I'm sure there's a better way to strike the balance, and we'll strive to do that. I read recently in a book written by a Marylander named Frank Islam that I think 50% of the wealth earned in our country is earned by 10% of our country's population, and 25% of it, namely half of that 50, is earned by the top 1%.
Right. That's madness.
Yeah. So what we need to figure out how to do, and what we need to acknowledge in our actions, is the truth that we're all in this together. And as a society, when we make investments in things like more affordable rather than more expensive college, and when we make investments in improving public education, eliminating health disparities, improving the skills levels of our workforce, and also tackling the healthcare hyperinflation, I think that, unfortunately, as a party, we haven't made the business case for why that's so important, so businesses can reinvest in their own hiring, can reinvest in their plant, can reinvest in R&D and innovation. These are all of the things that made us a great republic to begin with, and we've been going away from it for some reason. Deval Patrick, the governor of Massachusetts, in his inaugural, talked about, perhaps quoting Maryland's Tom Friedman, talked about the grasshopper generation. We have all heard Tom Brokaw talk about the great generation, guys my father's era, who fought the Second World War, the GI Bill, and that rising tide of opportunity that came from those fundamental investments and the skills, talents, innovative capacity, and creative capacity of our people. And Governor Patrick contrasted that with what Tom Friedman calls the grasshopper generation, that somehow we think, I don't know why, somehow we think that we don't need to pay for things like bridges or the next generation of high-speed rail, that the pipes that are underground for us aren't supposed to get old like they did for our parents and grandparents when they replaced them and built the great cities of our nation. So we got to shake ourselves out of this myth, this frame that the more we cut taxes and reduce our investment in the future, the better it is for job creation. No other society has ever worked that way, and the big gulf between what we need to invest for our kids' future and what we are investing.
As I said, I could dominate this, but I won't. I'll go back to our dear guest who traveled all the way to Annapolis to be here. Please,
Ray Sullivan. I live here in Hillsmere. I mean, in Annapolis, in a community called Hillsmere, and an activist in local environmental issues and health care, and worked a lot on the local Democratic campaign.
The Hillsmere Swim Club, right?
Yeah, I've swum in that pool, but I'm a little old for the swim club. Anyway, my question, though, is more general on the budget. Right now, the federal government is running a huge deficit. It's spending a huge amount of money on the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. And what I would like to see the leadership here in Annapolis do is approach the feds, ask them to stop funding the wars, bring the troops home safely, take that money and spend it on the environment, education, and health care. And that could make a huge difference in taking the burden off the state.
All right. Well, thank it you. Certainly would be good to make investments in things that last and pay dividends to the next generation. There's the last, what was it, 10? This was the most extended, protracted war that our country has ever been involved in, I do believe.
Right.
And and thank you for pointing out that the big driver of the deficit is this credit card financed, protracted series of desert wars that we have been engaged in. A lot of courageous and brave young Marylanders and Americans have given their lives in this conflict. Lieutenant Governor Brown and I go to every deployment ceremony, every SAD ceremony, and we also go to the welcome home ceremonies. And I have to tell you, the welcome home ceremonies are our favorite. And I hope, as the president has removed our combat forces from Iraq, that day cannot come soon enough, I'm sure, in all of our eyes, when we get out of Afghanistan and return to the urgent mission of building our own nation and rebuilding our nation. The biggest drivers to the federal deficit are the credit card finance wars on our kids' credit cards and permanent tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans who really don't need it as much as the next generation needs us to make the right choices now.
Well, he was asking, I mean, as leaders of the nation's governors, elected by your fellows to be the head of the association, can governors make a push with the federal government united to end the wars and bring those dollars back home to America to invest in us, in our people, our children, our infrastructure, our environment?
Yes, and I think you see that happening. I mean, it hasn't happened as quickly as any of us would like, but elections matter, and you've seen a shift in policy with President Obama's election. And there were quite a number of governors that were working so very, very hard in his campaign because they wanted to bring our guys, our men and women, home. And you'll see that continue. And I thought you were going somewhere else with that question, but when the nation's governors get together, you can almost see this big divide. One group of us, known as the Democratic governors, are always talking about investing in education, investing in the skills of our people, investing in the new economy, making this new economy ours, harnessing innovation, and the other guys are not in that space.
And by the way, just as we go to the next questioner, I got some critical emails from the people saying there can't be a summit, there are no Republicans up here talking. And that's because they weren't elected, or they would be here. I just want to say that's the reason that they're not. This is not a back-and-forth debate. It's a debate with, it's discussion with our highest elected officials in the state of Maryland. Go ahead, ma'am.
Hi, my name is Megan Cronin, and I'm with Environment Maryland. And first, Governor O'Malley, I wanted to thank you so much for introducing such a strong watershed implementation plan for the Bay. And my question is about the future of fertilizer policy in Maryland. It's come to my attention that runoff from lawn fertilizer is a huge source of pollution to the Chesapeake Bay, and it's one that needs to be urgently addressed and reduced. And a fifth of Maryland's land cover is home lawns, and that proportion is growing with every year that we develop. And in these hard economic times and with TMDL goals that need to be met, fertilizer reduction plans make sense. They're cheap, they're effective, and there are lots of graphs that show this. New Jersey is just one of the many states that have introduced this legislation. They did it very recently, and I would like to know if you think that Maryland could be the next state to step up to the plate.
They not only introduced it, they passed it, right?
Well, right, they passed it. Yeah, they signed it last week.
Boy, do I hate it, particularly when New Jersey beats us to something. Were you at the transition that we had on the Eastern Shore on the environment? We had about 700 people that came together for a whole day. We've been doing transitions instead of focusing department by department, where every transition committee concludes their work by saying, this department, unlike all the others, needs more money. We've instead focused on the big goals, like a more sustainable, cleaner, greener Maryland. Another one was on skills of our people. Another one was on job creation in the new economy. Did a health one on health the other day, and then security and public safety is tomorrow. But that issue came up, and I think there is a bill that is being proposed in the General Assembly by someone, isn't there?
There is, yeah.
I've heard rumor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we need to look at it, and these are the things that we need to do together, take the actions that we need to take, because that watershed improvement plan, as hard as it might have been to write, it's even harder to do. It's going to take a lot of action, and a lot of us haven't. We need to become much more, I don't know what the word is, engaged. I need to do a better job of getting counties on board or getting communities on board at the county, at the neighborhood level, at the watershed level. We have some great websites, by the way, for anybody listening along here. Baystat, we have Stream Health that's online. Our state makes better use of GIS, Geographic Information Systems, and mapping than any other state does when it comes to environmental remediation. And I'm looking forward to that conversation about changes in something as ubiquitous as Scrabble word, ubiquitous, as the fertilizer on our lawns. We touched off one. There was, I think it was Brian Frost, Senator Frost, that had the bill on banning phosphorus from dishwashing detergent. At the time, the captains of industry said, this is horrible, you know, bad things will fall from the sky, dogs and cats will live together, you can't do this. And then lo and behold, just 5 years later, I think the entire industry changed. Every state started doing it, and you've seen the waters of the Chesapeake Bay, while still having a long way to go, are cleaner than they've been in the last 6 years. So perhaps this lawn fertilizer idea is something like that, that everybody can take part in and be proud of.
Yeah, I hope so. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll get you on the air to push that. Go ahead, next.
Carly Mercer with Maryland Public Interest Research Group, and my question is about energy efficiency, specifically Empower Maryland goals. While it appears that Maryland is on track to reach the Empower Maryland goals, the utilities are very far behind where they need to be, and also a lot of the decrease in energy use is due to the economic downturn. What is your plan to really get the utilities on track to meet these goals so that we can make some real energy savings when the economy does rebound?
Thank you. Great question. Among the 15 big strategic goals, Mark, is our goal of reducing energy consumption by 15% by 2015, which was the Empower Maryland goal. We could have a robust conversation about the degree to which the overattainment of that energy conservation is attributable to the recession and how much of it is attributable to the actions that we've taken. I think it's probably a combination of the two. One of the things where we're demonstrably way ahead of the curve is on peak reduction. What's the term of art? Peak reduction
peak
demand?
Reduction.
I'm the one generalist in the family. I have to take a refresher every now. Peak reduction demand, which in essence you sign up with the utility company, then they can control your thermostat in those peak times when the hottest days they pull down your air conditioning when nobody's in the house anyway. So that's one thing that we've done. The change in terms of, you know, the weatherization is part of this. The Recovery and Reinvestment Act dollars funded and the industry that's growing up around that. The clean energy, the clean jobs, green jobs goal is a part of this. The bill that we're going to be introducing, I'm not supposed to talk about legislative stuff today, am I? The bill that we're going to be introducing that gives credit to solar hot water heaters is part of that when we introduce it. Don't tell anyone.
Keep it on down low.
So all of those things are things that we do together. We do map this. By the way, if anybody wants to see graphs that are moving in both the wrong direction and the right direction and flatlined, the place on the state government website to find this is under the delivery unit where we have each of those 15 goals and the graphs that support them. So those are some of the things that we'll do together. And if you have other ideas, by golly, now's the time.
Great. Thank you for making it a priority.
Thank you.
In a larger question here, in the last 7 or 8 minutes we have, so we'll get you the question next, is on the energy issue. I mean, the reality is that just kind of say, refitting our storm drains and reducing runoff that way could cost $10 to $20 billion. I mean, where does the money come from to really, and then people are talking about cutting back on the program that preserves land in Maryland, because cuts can happen from someplace. Many people are guessing that's one place those cuts are going to come from, is that program. And that you look at that, and the combination of that, and people are saying that, you know, the how we're going to get our energy in the future, where's it going to come from? You're pushing wind power. Other people are also saying we're going to do fracking, going after the gas, which has caused people's water to be destroyed across America. Go to Wyoming, where I visit, and you turn on the tap, and because of fracking, the water's on fire. I mean, so we're facing real issues about our energy future. So in terms of cost and what you think you can get done in the next 4 years, give us a reality check and assessment.
Sure. All of those things are connected. There's a certain unity to all of those things. You ask, Mark, where the money comes from for this. The money comes from us. The money comes from all of us. Where does the money come from for permanent tax cuts for the wealthiest 1% of Americans? That comes from us. Where does the money come from, even in credit card financed, never-ending desert wars? Where does that come from? It comes from us. Who bears the cost of exploiting minerals and permanently damaging and diminishing our natural resources of our streams and our woods and our bays and our river? That cost is carried by us. The cost of not taking action on renewable energy, is where does the cost of that get absorbed? It gets absorbed by us. What we have lost sight of is the inclusive nature of that word, U.S. It includes the next generation. And sadly, what we're doing and what we're not doing it and how we're doing and not doing it is a cost that we are placing on the next generation and the one after that. If we don't do something as a species on global warming, half of the lower shore is going to be underwater in the future. So the costs are all our costs. The freedom to do something about it, though, is ours. And probably the greatest freedom is the freedom to be responsible in our own time, to keep faith with the past, but to do right by the next generation. And so, you know, in our state, in the state capital, in this session, in our nation, we need to find ways to recognize, to realize, to respect the unity that is, and find ways to work together that's consistent with that unity. And that's the great human challenge.
We only have a few minutes left, and I did promise I would go back to the audience.
Good morning, Governor. Good morning. Brock Cancellieri.
Hello again, Jen.
Hello.
You were there at the all-day sustainability transition.
It was very helpful. Thank you. I'm with the Maryland League of Conservation Voters, and I'm actually going to ask a follow-up question to what you're talking about right now. I asked in the previous session the Senate President and the Speaker about bringing offshore wind to Maryland.
Got
to
do it.
Great.
Yeah, we need offshore wind.
Sign the bill today.
Yes. If you go on the state website and look under the delivery unit and look at the goal on renewable energy, you'll see a very clear sort of wedge analysis that shows us as we ramp up what portion of a 20% renewable energy portfolio is solar, what part is biomass, what part is geothermal, and what part is offshore wind. The biggest natural resource with the technology available today that we have for renewable energy is that offshore wind. And some states have moved out on this in advance of us, which in a way can be helpful because they've cleared the path. I think Delaware showed just how important a long-term power purchase contract is, and we need to figure out a way to do that. So stay tuned.
I think that we're just about wrapping up time here. We are wrapping up. So there's that time popping up on my screen. Governor Martin O'Malley, thank you for being with
Mark,
us today.
Mark, thank you.
Annapolis Summit Wednesday, our 8th annual Annapolis Summit, hosted by the Baltimore Business Journal, WEAA, of course, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, broadcasting also on Delmarva Public Radio. Our sponsors, Stevenson University, the Maryland State Education Association, the Greater Baltimore Committee. We're here at the Historic Inns of Annapolis. I want to thank them as well for their support, Progressive Maryland, contributed to today's events as well. We want to thank them as well for their support of this, and for the governor and the speaker and the president for turning out 8 years in a row, well, 4 years in a row for you, five maybe now, to join us here of the citizens of Maryland, and of course the Baltimore City Office of Cable and Communications, TV 25, for being able to tape it so we can share it with the citizens of the state of Maryland and across the country. Thanks to our engineer, Zachary Coleman, WEA Public Radio, and of course my producers, Christine Harrison and Justin Levy. And I'm Mark Steiner. Thank you all for coming. We'll be here again next year, and we'll be here all during the session. Thank you, Governor.
Thank you, Mark. Thanks a lot.